Osho, Tao, the Three Treasures, Volume 3. Talks on fragments from Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 8.
The first question. I feel so much self-confident that I will be enlightened very soon. But then I feel that it will be nice if my enlightenment is a little delayed, because there seems to be greater joy in delaying enlightenment than to be enlightened. Why? Don't feel so much confident. Otherwise, it will be delayed forever. Self-confidence is not a quality into the inner journey. It is a barrier. In the outer world, self-confidence is a help. It's a must. Without it, you cannot go anywhere in the outside world, because ego is needed, struggle is needed, a sort of madness is needed. But when you move to the inner, all the qualities that are helpful in the outer journey become obstacles. Self is not needed. Self-confidence is not needed. One should completely lose the self. Only then there is a possibility of enlightenment. You never become enlightened. When you are not, there is enlightenment. First thing to remember. And the second, how can you compare that which is better? Enlightenment are waiting for it. The comparison is possible only when you have become enlightened. When you know both, then you can compare. Don't befool yourself. Don't try to rationalize it, because you have to wait. You are now trying to rationalize it, that there is much beauty, much happiness, bliss in waiting. If in waiting there is much bliss, more bliss than enlightenment, then those who attained it were fools. Buddha, Lao Tzu, Krishna, Jesus. Is stupid, all is stupid. Then what is the point of trying to attain it? No, you are trying to befool yourself. Nowhere it seems to be coming nearer. And the mind is very cunning and very tricky. It says, who is in a hurry? If it is not coming, it is very beautiful. To wait is good. And very blissful. Now you are trying to hide an impotency. This way you can go on in circles. First, it is being delayed. It will be delayed. It can be delayed forever. If too much self is there, it is delayed because of you. Not that there is any bliss in waiting. Waiting is always a misery. Waiting is always hanging in the middle. It is to be in the limbo. Waiting is always tense. A suffering. Otherwise, who would like to reach? For what you are waiting? Waiting to reach. Waiting cannot be beautiful, but you can try to console yourself. Drop the self and drop false consolations. Because nobody else is fooled by it except yourself. You are not deceiving anybody, but you can deceive yourself for eternity. Drop the self, drop that too much confidence. It is egoistic. And suddenly there is enlightenment. There is no need to wait. Waiting is because of the obstacles that you are creating. Enlightenment is not creating any obstacles on your path. God is not pushing you away from Himself. Nobody is creating any difficulty for you. If you are not reaching, it is only because of you. So drop self-confidence, drop the self, and then suddenly you find that enlightenment is not something that happens to you. Enlightenment is your very nature, your very being. When the self is not, it is. Then it is yourself. And forget all consolations. You must have heard, I have told it many times myself, the famous story of the fox and the grapes. One of the very extraordinary men, Aesop, wrote it. A fox comes near. And the tree is full of grapes, bunches of grapes. She jumps, she tries hard, but cannot reach to the grapes. They are too far away. Her jump is not so long. Then she looks all around. Is somebody watching? A small hare was watching from a bush. And he asked, "Auntie, what is the matter? Could not you reach to the grapes?" She said, "No, son. That is not the thing. The grapes are sour. This is consolation. I tell you, grapes are never sour. At least the grapes of enlightenment. Never sour. They are always ripe and sweet. And if you cannot reach, don't try to console yourself that you love waiting. Just try to understand why you are forced to wait. Who is forcing you to wait? And you will not find anybody else. You yourself, that self-confidence and the self. The second question is, the chaos that is occurring today in our age any different from that of other times? It feels as though it is a special time. Or is it that all time is special? Yes, all time is special. Every moment is special. But every age feels that this age is special. That is the ego of the age. Every age has always felt that there has never been such a time, such a revolutionary time, such chaos, such wars, such knowledge, such wisdom. But something special I have heard. I don't know how far it is correct, but it must be. Knowing human mind, it has to be. When Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden, it is said that the first words they uttered getting out of the gate, Adam said to Eve, "Dear, this is the greatest revolutionary time we are passing through." The first day of the world, the first moment rather, the first step in the world and the revolution. This is the greatest revolutionary time we are passing through. And since then, every Adam has felt that. And every Adam has said to the Eve, "Dear, this is the greatest age we are living through. Very special." Why this happens? The age is special. The religion you are born in is special. The master you follow is special, the greatest in the world. The book you believe in is written by God Himself, not by ordinary human beings. Everything that belongs to you is special. This is how the ego is helped, supported. These are the props. The country you are born is special. If you are an Indian, then the country is sacred. If you are English, then you know well that you are the best in the world. If you are French, the same. This happens, and this is such a cunning method that you will not be aware what you are doing to yourself. Making your religion special, you become special. It is not that Christianity is special. In fact, it is you who are so special. Because of you, the Christianity appears to be special. It is not India that is a sacred land. It is because of you. You are so religious. So sacred is your being. Because of you, the whole India becomes a religious country, special. Wherever you were born, the same would have happened. If you were born in Holland, are in China, the same would have happened. Try to see into it. The world is always either ordinary or extraordinary. Because there is no point in saying that it is always extraordinary. That doesn't make any difference. If there are ordinary moments, then only some moments can be extraordinary. So you can call either the world is always ordinary, the time ordinary, the country, the religion, everything. Or you can call it is always extraordinary, it is the same. Because there is nothing to compare with, to contrast with. And by, if you drop these props, suddenly you will disappear. Your country ordinary, then you cannot walk so heartily as you used to walk. Your language ordinary, then you will hesitate a little. If everything is ordinary, your birth, your family, this and that, then where and how you can help the ego to be strong? All props withdrawn, ego falls to the ground. These are very subtle tricks. I have heard about a professor of philosophy in the University of Paris, who one day suddenly he told to his students that I am the greatest man in the world. They could not believe. This ordinary professor, and that too not a professor of physics, of philosophy. Nobody comes to study even. Rarely some mad people come. And nobody bothers about his department, the most neglected in the university. And he is the biggest man of the world. They laughed. They said, "We have always heard that philosophers are a little eccentric, but now you prove it. You and the biggest man of the world." And what about Richard Nixon and Mao Zedong and Indira Gandhi? What about these people? He said, "Wait, whenever I say something, I prove it. I am a logician. I will prove it. I have a proof. Unless I have a proof, I will never make such a statement." He brought next day the map of the whole world. He fixed it on the wall and he said, "Come near. Now I will prove. Which is the greatest country in the world?" Of course it is France, because all are French. So the whole world is dropped, only the France remains. And then he said, "Which is the greatest town, city in France?" Of course it is Paris, all are Parisians. Then he said, "And which is the greatest place in Paris?" Of course it is the university, the citadel of wisdom. Now the students started feeling a little restless, because he is coming to the point. And it will be difficult now to disprove. And then he said, "Which is the best and the greatest department in the university?" Of course it has to be philosophy, the most ancient, the secret most knowledge. And who is the head of the department of philosophy? He is the greatest man in the world. This is how you all function. This is the logic. This is the proof. Please don't be foolish. Let philosophers be foolish, you need not be. Drop all such nonsense. It is all garbage. And once you drop it, you will feel so clean, as if you have taken a bath in eternity. You will feel so unburdened, so young, because all this rot on your head is making you rotten. You are ill because of it. You cannot be healthy unless you throw all this garbage. Be simple, ordinary. Everything is ordinary. Or you can call it extraordinary, that makes no difference. This morning is as extraordinary as any morning. And people have always thought like that. Whenever you fall in love, you feel this woman, this is the queen, Cleopatra. There has never been such a woman. But every lover has felt like that. And not only that, you will fall again and again in love, and again you will feel that. Now, real Cleopatra, that was nothing. And you will forget that you have been saying the same thing to many women. Every lover feels an ego enhancement. And this has been the cause of much misery in the world. Christians think they are special, the very chosen of the God. Jews think they are very special. God has made them the chosen race. And that has created much misery in the world. If you are the chosen race, then you are forgiven all sins. You can do whatsoever you like. Nobody is chosen, or everybody is chosen. The dog on the street is also a chosen dog. And an ordinary grass is also chosen. And the stars are also chosen. You are also chosen. Either all are chosen or nobody is chosen. It is for you to decide. But never say, I am chosen. Because then what about others? Met people like Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, Tojo, Stalin. They all feel they are the chosen people. They are made to govern. And others are made to be governed. These people create trouble. But you also have the same seed within you. If you allow it to grow, you can become an Adolf Hitler. Nobody is special. Life is so beautiful in its ordinariness, so extraordinary in its ordinariness. Why bring these nonsense concepts in it and disturb it? Third question, does a sinner deserve to be enlightened? Otherwise, who else? A saint is already enlightened. Only sinners are left to be enlightened. But religions have taught you something which is creating the problem. They have condemned you as sinners. How you can become enlightened? Sin is nothing but error. There is no condemnation in the world. It is just error. And those who err, they learn. All saints have been sinners. There has never been a saint who has not been a sinner. Otherwise, how he will come to become a saint? He traveled. He erred. He went astray. He fell million at times and rose up again. He has reached the whole journey. He has been a sinner. Now he has learned, and now no error happens. He has become wise through sinning, through errors. He knows. He has become enlightened. But out of the darkness of the night is the morn born. Every saint has been a sinner, and every sinner will become a saint. The past of the saint is bound to be of sin, and the future of every sinner is bound to be of saintlyhood. So between a saint and a sinner is only a difference of past and future, that's all. Don't feel condemned. Sin in itself is enough. Why burden yourself even more by condemnation? Be alert. That's all. You will have to commit mistakes. But don't commit the same mistake again. That's all. Be alert. Watch. And learn. In fact, if you ask me, then I will tell you that the world of sin is the world of learning. One cannot learn without it. One has to go deep in sin. It is just like the roots of a tree. The deeper the roots go, higher go the branches. The tree goes to a great height, but it depends, is based on the roots which go deeper and deeper and deeper. If you come across a great saint, you must know that he must have sinned greatly. The roots must go deep. Otherwise, how can he know so much? If he has never sinned, he will be not innocent, but is stupid. There are stupid saints also. To me, they are not saints. They are simply afraid people, cowards. They have never sinned. They never went astray. They have always clung to the right path, to the well-trodden path, to the ideology the society has given to them, to the concept the religion has enforced on their mind, to the conditioning that they have been born into. They have clung to it. They have never moved astray. They are cowards. They have learned nothing. To me, their value is zero. They may be good people, but their goodness is saltless. It has no flavor. It is a little dull and dead. You will find two types of saints in the world. One who is because of fear of the hell, fear of the consequence, and never sinned. He is almost a clay saint, not really. He has not achieved to anything. And you will not find him wise, because from where he will get the wisdom? He never went astray. From where he will become mature? He will be a child, ignorant, foolish and stupid, not harmful, but you cannot learn through him anything. At the most, he can teach you his stupidity, his cowardliness. There is another type of saint. You are fortunate if you can find a saint of the other type, because if 100 saints exist, 99 are stupid. It has to be so. That is the proportion between stupidity and intelligence. So it has to be always the same proportion everywhere. In the world, on the marketplace, the same proportion exists. 99 stupid person, 1 person intelligent, wise, aware. The same proportion has to be reflected in the saints also, in all directions. If you can find the one who has lived and lived dangerously and moved in all directions without any fear and learned through experience to transcend sin. Not that he never committed sin. He committed, and he committed it totally and intensely. That's why he could transcend it. He could see through and through. He could see the very absurdity of it. That's why he has become transcendental to it. If you can find such a saint, only through him goes the path, the way. Jesus could say to people, I am the way. Jesus is not ordinary, stupid saint. That was the reason why he was crucified. If he had been an ordinary, stupid saint, he would have been worshipped. Jews would have proclaimed him that here is the Son of God. But the trouble was that his ways were not exactly right as Jews used to think what right is. They were not exactly moral. Sometimes he stayed with a prostitute. This is not saintly like. Sometimes he stayed with drunkards. And he himself used to drink wine. He loved it. And he moved with all sorts of people. He was not respectable in any way. He didn't care a bit for respectability. Immoral people, condemned by the society, were his friends. He moved in all sorts of companies. That was the reason. Basic reason was, deep down he was cutting the roots of the old morality. All the priests and all the so-called stupid saints were against him. This man is dangerous. He has to be destroyed. Because he is bringing something in the world which will be a chaos for the ordinary morality. Because ordinary morality lives by rules, and a saint lives by awareness, not by rules. Rules are for those who are cowards. A saint lives by his inner discipline. He believes in no other discipline. His own consciousness is the only law. He follows it. Wherever it leads, he is ready to go. If it goes to hell, he will go to hell. Because that is his way to know the truth. He follows his own being. He does not allow anybody to enforce anything on him. He rebels. Ordinary saints are harmless, but saints like Jesus are dangerous to the society, to the culture, to the fixed mode of life, to the status quo, to the establishment. Jesus must have looked like a hippie, rebellious, breaking all the rules. That's how one should live. Because unless you live total free, unless you suffer through your own choice, you will not transcend anything. You will remain a clay saint. You ask, does a sinner deserve to be enlightened? And I say, who else? He has earned it. Through sin he has suffered. Through sin he has become mature. But I am not saying that just by sinning you will attain to it. Otherwise all would have attained. Sin plus awareness. That should be the formula. Sin plus awareness. Then go wherever you want and do whatsoever you like. That awareness will bring you back. That awareness will always be the ladder from by which you can always transcend any experience. in India, if Jesus was born, he would not have been crucified. No. That has never been our practice here, because we have known even more dangerous people. Jesus is nothing. We have known Krishna. In fact, there is every possibility that Christ is a deformed form of Krishna. Jesus must have given something of the quality of Krishna. In Bengali, Krishna is Krishto. In many European languages, Christ is Christo. Christ seems to be a form of Krishna. Christ is not Jesus' name. Jesus Christ means Jesus the Krishna. Something of Krishna was in him. Being in love with Mary Magdalene, something like Krishna in love with Radha. Jews could not believe. They are very moralistic people, mathematical, calculating. And here comes this man and he will disrupt the whole structure. We allowed Krishna 16,000 girlfriends. We call them gopis. Gopi is a better word than girlfriend, more lovely and more deep. 16,000 we allowed and we never crucified this man. And all were not married to him. Few of them were others' wives. Radha herself was not his wife, somebody else. Just few days before, there has been a case in Uttar Pradesh in a court about a certain land. A certain land for centuries has been in Radha Krishna's name. Now the new rules are coming, and that much land cannot be in one man's name. But the judge has given his judgment, and it is beautiful. He said, because it is in the name of Radha Krishna, it is not in one man's name. And because Radha was never a legal wife to him, these are two persons. So the land can remain. Because it is in two persons, it can be. For two persons, that much land can be allowed. And they were never a family, because he was never married to her. His wife's name people have completely forgotten. His wife's name was Rukmani. It is completely a forgotten name. Radha was not his wife. Radha was his mistress. And India never bothered to kill this man. Rather, on the contrary, we have said that he is the absolute avatar, the total coming of God on the earth. Because why we have called him the total God? He can sin like a sinner, the greatest sinner, and he remains like a saint, the greatest ever known. Two polarities meet in him. He is total. If a saint is simply a saint and has never sinned, he is one polar. Something is missing. When a man is two polars, both the polarities are there, the man is total and alive. He is both night and day, life and death, chaos and cosmos. So I tell you, you ask, does a sinner deserve to be enlightened? Yes, only a sinner deserves. But awareness has to be brought in. So I don't condemn sin. I only indicate you that sin, but sin with conscious, alert, aware mind. Do whatsoever you like. If you want to take wine, take it, but remain alert. Soon you will find that this is impossible. When you take wine, you lose awareness. And when you lose awareness, then it is simple sin. Then there is no possibility of saintliness happening in it. If you can drink and remain alert, you drink as much as you want. It is water, nothing else. It is said that Jesus turned water into wine. I teach you the other trick, how to turn wine into water. Be aware. Then you will do a greater miracle than Jesus ever did. Be aware and wine becomes water. Be aware, sex becomes love. Be aware, love becomes prayer. Be aware, prayer becomes meditation. Simply one thing has to be remembered, do whatsoever you like, do it with full consciousness, and then you will not go astray. The fourth question, can one get over addicted to catharsis? Yes. Mind has a very deep rooted disease I call the disease of OD. Overdose. Overdoing. Remain alert of this disease of OD. You can do anything too much. And then that which was going to be beneficial will become harmful. Food is good. It is vitality. But you can eat too much. It becomes poisonous. You can die by overeating. In fact, medical researchers say that people die more of overeating than of starvation. Newspapers go on reporting that few people have died somewhere because of starvation. They never report how many people are dying by overeating. That should be reported first. More people are always dying by overeating. A man can live for 3 months without eating anything at all. But you overeat even 3 weeks, you cannot survive. You try for 3 days, eat as much as you can. It happened, Mullah Nasruddin went for a visit to Mecca, Hajj, and he was followed by a disciple. The disciple had a curious habit. Whenever they will eat, he will eat something and then he will shake his body. Then he will eat again and again shake his body. One day Nasruddin said, "What you do, you never tell me the secret. And I am your master. And you are my disciple and you go on hiding the secret. Tell me, what is the secret of this?" The disciple said, "If you shake your body, things settle. Then you feel again hungry, you can eat more. Then you again shake your body. It is just like a box. You settle things, settle. Nasruddin hit him hard on the head. And he said, "You fool, and you never told me. I always suspected that there is more to eating and more can be done, but I never knew this trick. I know that the very last limit of eating is busting. But you should have told me, and you are my friend and my disciple, and you have been hiding such a great secret, and now I feel so miserable. How much food I have missed." Remember the disease of OD. It kills in many ways. Overeating, overloving can kill you. Many people come to me, they are doing oversex. They are killing themselves. Overeating, they are killing themselves. Yes, you can do over meditation also. The mind always likes to do something to the extreme. Mind is the extremist. It never wants to be in the middle. Because to be in the middle is to be without mind. To be exactly in the middle and there is no mind. When you move to the extreme, mind enters. The more further away you go from the center, the mind comes in and takes your position. Either eat too much or fast too much and mind will be there. That's why I am neither in favor of eating too much nor in favor of fasting. Just be in the middle. Right eating. Exactly balanced. And always remember in everything to be balanced. You can overdo meditation. And then you will be exhausted. Rather being resurrected through it and revived and revitalized and rejuvenated, you will feel exhausted. And then you will go to the other extreme. You will say, "Nothing. This meditation is nothing. I must stop. I am dying because of it." You are not dying because of it. You are dying because of overdoing. So how to know that this is the middle? Difficult, very difficult. One needs to be very, very conscious. Only then one knows. When you eat, where is the middle? The middle is when you still are feeling a little hungry, just a little hungry, and you know that now if you eat, you will feel heavy. Just there, stop. If you eat 4 chapatis and then you feel heavy, then 3 chapatis is the right thing to stop there. 3/4 of your stomach should be full, 1/4 empty. That is the right thing. Because give a little space for the food to move, to be transformed, to be changed into blood. Give a little space. Food needs a little space in the stomach. If you are meditating and you feel you are doing too much catharsis, catharsis will become a very, very exhausting phenomenon. You are crying in meditation. Cry up to the moment when you start feeling now you are losing energy. You are feeling weaker. If you cry more, you will be simply exhausted and nothing else. Stop. Always stop when you feel that the energy is being lost, not regained. If catharsis is real, necessary, then by catharsis you will feel unburdened. You will feel light. You will feel as if you can fly. But if you can go on doing it more and more, thinking that more will be helpful, more, then soon you will find you are simply just dead. You cannot move. One has to watch it. There cannot be a fixed rule for everybody, because everybody's body has a different quality, different energy, different quantity of energy. One has to watch oneself. If you are sleeping less than necessary, then the whole day you will feel sleepy. If you are sleeping too much than necessary, then also the whole day you will feel dull. Not sleepy, but dull. There is an exact moment. If you get up in that moment, you will feel fresh the whole day, neither sleepy nor dull. And you have to search that moment for yourself, because nobody else's moment will do. That's how all scriptures become useless. If somewhere it is said that get up early in the morning, 5 o'clock, it may have suited the man who has written this. It may not suit you. And then you can get up at 5 and suffer. And then you will think, I am a sinner because of past karmas. This is happening, otherwise my master has said 5 is the exact time. In Vinoba's ashram, they get up at 3 o'clock. Many suffer. Then they sleep the whole day. Or if they are not allowed to sleep, they feel sleepy. They cannot be conscious. They move as if fast asleep. Somnambulists. It suits to Vinoba. It does not mean it is going to suit everybody. It suits to him because his food is such, more sleep is not needed. He takes only curd. Almost he lives on curd. Even milk needs to be digested. Curd is almost digested, because first milk goes in the body and becomes curd, and then curd is almost a digested food. And he eats very little because he has ulcers, chronic ulcers. So it suits him. But his followers take curd. If they don't have ulcers, they will have fullness. They will simply create more acidity in their stomach. And then he gets at 3 o'clock because he cannot sleep more than that. They all get up at 3 o'clock. Then the whole ashram feels the whole day sleepy. I have been there. I have seen those people's faces. Somnambulists, as if in hypnosis. How can they become more alert and aware, and how can they meditate? Find out your own rhythm. And everybody has his own rhythm. And the rhythm is as different as your fingerprints, as your thumbprint is different from everybody else in the world. Exactly the same way, everything is unique with every individual. You have your own rhythm about everything. I have worked on many people, and this has been my understanding, that everyone is so different that no fixed rule can be applied. Only flexible understanding, that's all. And you have to find your own rhythm. About catharsis also, try to find your own rhythm. This should be the criterion, that if catharsis is exhausting, then you are overdoing it. If it is not overdone, you will feel after it very, very beautiful, light, as if gravitation is no more functioning. You will walk as if you are dancing. Your step will have a dance to it. And that is a feeling you have to find out. If you work well, alert, within 3 months you can find every rhythm about you. When you should go to sleep, when you should get up. You have to create your own yoga. Don't follow anybody else's rhythm. Otherwise you will be in difficulty and you will never be healthy. Sixth question, what is the relationship between love and responsibility? Does loving another person mean trying to solve their problems as well as your own? If you can solve your own, that is already too much. Please never try to solve anybody else's problem. You will create a mess. You have not solved your own. Never do that. The mind has a tendency and a temptation to do it. You ask, what is the relationship between love and responsibility? No relationship, because love is responsibility. But the word has to be understood well, what it means. I insist for the root meaning of the word. Responsibility means ability to respond. It is, does not mean a duty. Responsibility. Go to the root meaning of the word. It means to be responding. Love is a response. When the other calls, you are ready. When the other invites, you enter the other. When the other is not inviting, you don't interfere. You don't trespass. When the other sings, you sing in response. When the other gives you her or his hand, you take it with deep response. Responsibility means openness, readiness to respond. Somebody is calling and you don't respond. You remain closed. Somebody wants to love you, but you don't help, you don't cooperate. Rather, you create barriers. If this is the thing you are doing, and almost majority of lovers go on doing this, when the other calls, you don't respond. Then when you call, the other does not respond. Because when the other calls, you see that this will be good ego enhancing thing not to respond, then you feel your own master. Nobody can pull you, and nobody can pull you into something which you were not going already. You don't follow anybody. Comes your beloved and she is happy and she would like to be in a deep silence with you, but you remain closed. Then when you call, there is no answer. Have you seen birds calling each other? That is responsibility. A cuckoo calls. There is silence. And then another cuckoo responds. By their sounds, by their song, they answer. They may be far away in farther away trees, then they start flying closer. They have responded. By and by they come to the same tree, then they are sitting together, loving. When the other's being calls, ready, be ready. Respond with your totality. Don't be a miser. That is the meaning of responsibility. But in your sense, love has no responsibility. The world has been corrupted, destroyed, poisoned. A mother says to the child, I'm your mother. You have to be responsible for me. A husband says, I'm your husband. And I work hard for you. You have to be responsible for me. A father says to the son, don't be irresponsible. Whenever you do something, always think of me. This is not responsibility. You have corrupted a beautiful world. It has become ugly. Responsibility has become almost synonymous to duty. And duty is an ugly word. Love is beautiful. If you love your mother, you love. But it cannot be a duty. If it is duty, it is better not to love. Because duty is not going to satisfy her. And if you are doing your duty because she is your mother and she has given birth to you, so what to do? You have to take care. When she is ill, you have to sit by her side. But all the time, because it is duty, your mind is against her. You are feeling suffocated. You are feeling burdened in a bondage. You would like to rebel and revolt. And if this mother dies, you may not say to anybody, but you will feel relief. What type of responsibility is this? That the mother dies and the son feels a deep relief. Of course he cries and weeps. Of course. And not that he is showing others that he is crying and weeping. In fact, if you had loved your mother, there may have been no tears. But you have not loved the mother. Now the opportunity is lost. You never loved your mother and now she is gone. Hence the tears, the so much weeping and crying. It is pathological. It is not healthy. If you had really loved the mother, then what is there to weep and cry? She is gone. A deep silence surrounds you. In that deep silence, you start understanding death. You become aware of your own death. When your mother dies, your father dies, it is an indication you will have to die. Then you become involved with death. You try to understand. While she was alive, she helped you to understand life. Now she is gone. She has opened another door, the door of death, to look into. Because she has gone and you will have to follow. If you had loved a person, when the person is gone, you don't feel relief and you don't cry and you don't weep. In deep silence, you accept the fact, the helplessness of it. And the love continues, because love does not end on the body. Love does not end on the mind. Love goes on flowing. No, don't ask what is the relationship between love and responsibility. There is none. When there is no love, the question of responsibility comes in. When there is no love, you start talking about duty. When there is love, love itself is responsibility. And does loving another person mean trying to solve their problems as well as your own? No. Never try. That is trespassing. Accept the person as he is with all his problems. That is love. If he asks you, share your understanding, but don't try to change him. Very difficult. Because the mind is a manipulator. In the name of good, In the name of doing good, it tries to manipulate. It is a politician. The wife says, because you are smoking, I will have to fight with you, and you have to change your smoking. This is not good. You are destroying your health. And I have seen that a nagging wife destroys health more than any smoking. And the wife goes on nagging. And she says, it is because of your health. I love you. And for 30 years she has been nagging. Now they have been experimenting on nagging. And a very rare phenomena has been revealed. The wife is nagging, is screaming. And they have tried it on the food that you eat. The food you eat, you have eaten bread, butter, you have vegetable, fruit juice you have taken. They have put the fruit juice, the vegetable, the butter on a tray. And the wife is nagging and is screaming. It destroys the juice on the tray. The juice becomes toxic, poisonous. So just think what will be happening in the stomach. Because on the tray everything is still non-organic, dead in a way. The juice in a glass is destroyed. Then what will be happening to the juice in the stomach? Because then it has become part of your life stream. It is more alive. Nagging destroys life, health. And the wife is nagging for your health because you are smoking. If she really loved you, how can she nag? Impossible. How she can scream? She will simply love you. And she will love you so much and so deeply that the need for smoking will disappear. In fact, people smoke because they have not really deeply been kissed. If they are deeply kissed with tremendous love flowing, smoking will disappear. People are smoking because their mothers have not given them their breast as totally as it should be given. Reluctantly the breast was given to them, very reluctantly. An unfulfilled desire has remained in their mind. Now they are fulfilling that desire by smoking. Smoking is very symbolic. The cigarette functions as a nipple, and the heart is smoke flowing within functions as heart milk flowing from the mother's nipple. If all over the world mothers loved their children, there will be no need for smoking. It will simply disappear. It is a symptom. It is not a disease. Mother should learn, and nothing else can stop it. Now in America they have decided, the parliament has decided, that on every packet of cigarette it should be written that the Surgeon General has decided that smoking is harmful to health. Nothing has happened. Now it is written on the packet. It makes no difference. On the contrary, the sale of cigarettes has gone higher. Because people are suicidal. They want to destroy themselves. So if cigarette can destroy, okay, let it destroy. Their life has nothing worth preserving. So what you are saying, that it is harmful. People are suicidal. They are seeking something harmful to do to themselves. Because nobody accepts them. And they themselves don't accept them. If you love a person, you accept the total person with all the defects. Because those defects are a part of the person. But your love will change. Remember this, love never tries to change, but it changes tremendously. If you can love, that will bring a revolution. And it brings the revolution so silently that even the footsteps are not heard. Nobody ever becomes alert what is happening. Everything happens so silently. As the buds open and flowers, and no noise is heard. Just like that. And never try to change a person you love. Because the very effort to change says that you love half, and the half person is not accepted. That is the meaning of change. That you say, I love you, but I don't love your nose. I love you, but I don't love your face. One very fat girl said to me that only one boy loves her, and he says, I love your soul, but not your body. But all lovers go on saying such things, that I love you, but I can't love your smoking. I hate it. But that seems a rejection. And for the lover, smoking is part of his being. He cannot help. It is the way he is. Suddenly he shrinks. He is not accepted. You have poisoned a very beautiful thing like love for a very non-essential thing like smoking. If you love, you simply love. If love brings change, it is okay. If it does not bring change, that is also okay. Seventh question, why does love feel more illusory than hate? Yes, it feels. Love feels more illusory than hate because in love you have to drop the ego. And in hate, the ego is strengthened. That's why people love less and hate more. Even the person they love, they find something to hate in him. You hate 99% and 1% you love. And even that 1% looks dreamlike, because when the ego disappears in certain moments, you are not there. When the ego comes back, the ego cannot remember exactly what happened, because it was not there. It looks like a dream, as if it never happened. You simply dreamed about it. Ego has no memory of love experience. If you are really in love, for that single moment, ecstasy happens. The ego is not there. Boundaries merge, mingle, meet, disappear into each other. After the experience, when the ego is back, again boundaries have come. You are separate from the lover. The experience seems to be as if you have seen in a film, read in a novel. Or really it happened. The ego was not a witness to it. It is just like as in the morning you feel the night was good, you slept well. But if somebody insists, how do you know? Because you were so fast asleep, you shrug your shoulders. You yourself become a little hesitant. You say, yes, you are right. Just a feeling has remained. Because in a sleep, deep sleep, ego disappears. That's why Patanjali says in his Yoga Sutras that Samadhi and sleep have one thing in common, and that is the disappearance of the ego. Love and Samadhi have also one thing in common, the disappearance of the ego. And whenever ego disappears and the ego is so identified with you that without it you cannot function. Everything seems to be illusory. Hate seems to be more real. Fighting seems to be more a challenge. This is my observation, that many people love just to fight. And many people get interested into love affairs if there is some challenge, otherwise not. There are women who will fall in love only with somebody else's husband, never with a bachelor, because then there is no fight, no challenge. There are men who are always looking at others' wives but not interested with unmarried women, not interested. Because unless the triangle is there, the story seems to be meaningless. You cannot make a film without the triangle. You cannot write a novel without a triangle. Just twos, the whole thing seems to be a little boring. The third gives challenge, energy, and then you are alert and fighting. Even in love, you are seeking hate and fight and war and conflict, because ego feeds on conflict. So hate seems to be more real. That's why whenever there is war in the world, see people's faces, they look more radiant. Their walk has a different quality. They move fast. They look very interested. Just in the morning, in Bam Mahurt, they get up and inquire for the newspaper. And everywhere people are talking, and as if something is happening. When there is no war, they become dull. Life becomes a routine. Hate seems to be more real. And this should not be so. If you are alert, just the otherwise will be the case. Hate will become unreal, love will be real. Because the reality can be known only when the ego disappears. Through the ego, reality cannot be known. That is the barrier to reality. Eighth question, what is the best way to coexist with the little judge who resides in my head, banging his gavel, bad, bad, good, good. Don't judge the judge. Ninth question, what is the best, take a bath or do meditations? This has been asked by Dominique, a French visitor. As far as I know about Westerners, it is better to take a bath. After the bath, you can do the meditation also. But first take the bath. The body comes first. Clean the body. Because meditation is also a cleaning. A deeper cleaning of being. And if you are not cleaning the body, you will not be interested in cleaning the soul. Clean the body, that is the beginning. Clean the temple. Only then you can give the bath to the god inside the shrine. The 10th question, do I deserve to be enlightened? No, not at all. But don't be afraid and worried. Nobody needs to deserve. It is a gift of the divine. It is a prasad, a grace. In fact, the more you think you deserve, the less is the possibility of it to happen. The more you feel you don't deserve, the more is the possibility for it to happen. A allow it to happen. There is no question of deserving it, only allow it to happen. Eleventh question, when listening at your lectures, should we follow the intellectual meaning also? Is there any intellectual meaning also? There is none. I am talking a heart to the heart, a being to the being. Don't lose your path in the forest of intellectuality. Otherwise, you will listen something, but that will not be what I am saying. If you want to listen to me, listen from the heart. In fact, from the navel, from the belly. Forget the head. So that the being can commune with the being. Only then the meaning will be mine. If you listen to the intellect, the meaning will be given by you. You would have heard it, but I have not said it. The last question. It is from Bodhidharma. I feel I have come to so much emptiness or void that enlightenment can happen any moment. Only one step remains to be taken, but I feel that one step should come from the side of the Guru. First thing, this is good to feel that the last step should come from the Guru, but the last step never comes from the Guru. The last step one has to travel alone without the Guru. Because if in the last step also Guru remains with you, it is impossible for God to happen. You should be left alone, totally alone. So in the last step, the Guru by and by disappears. You are left alone. You have to take that courage and jump. Or you have to be courageous to remain open so that God can jump. But in the last moment, Guru is not there. Up to the last moment, he can help you. He prepares you for the last step, but in the last step, he cannot be there because then his own presence will be a disturbance. And when you will achieve to the last, then you will thank to the from your very heart. Then you will bow in gratefulness to your Guru, because he withdrew himself in the last moment. The Guru helps you so that everything else drops, only the Guru remains. Then the Guru withdraws himself. Then you are alone. In that total aloneness, God happens. There is no other way. The Guru would like to help you, but it cannot be done. It is simply not the way things happen. Enough for today.